cultural diversity, and housing and houselessness. I will take your phone calls as we work together to build the beloved community. This Friday, February 9th at 9 a.m. on KBOO.
February 13th, 1983, KBOO Community Radio held an open house to celebrate moving into a building that we could come to own here at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue. Join us Tuesday, February 13th for the 35th anniversary of the open house moving in party. Food, drinks, tours, and memories will be on hand as we celebrate 35 years in this building and 50 years of KBOO. That's the 35th anniversary open house, Tuesday, February 13th, 5 to 8 p.m., here at your community radio station, KBOO Portland. More information can be found at 50yearsofkboo.fm.
Hey, it's 11 o'clock and time for the bike show. Tori, Alon, and April are all in there ready to go. And today looks like they're going to talk about the history of women in cycling. Stay tuned. It's KBOO Portland.
I run around town, around, around, with the pedal to the metal, the pedal to whatever. I run around, round, around, round the town, with the pedal to the metal, the pedal to whatever. I run around town, around, round, around, with the pedal to the metal, the pedal to whatever. I run around, round, around, round the town, with the pedal to the metal.
Good morning. You're tuned in to The Bike Show, broadcasting live today from the KBOO studios in Portland, Oregon. I'm Tori Bortman, joined here today with my co-host, Alon Robb. Good morning, Alon.
Good morning. A sunny morning to you.
Oh, beautiful day outside. We haven't had that many of those in February recently, so it's lovely. And today, it's a perfect day because we're digging into the history of women in cycling. Starting from the earliest times of the bicycle, women were growing in power and freedom. There are many of these stories we already know, but today we're highlighting a few unsung heroes for their bravery, fortitude, and downright pluckiness. In the first half hour, we'll learn about Alfonsina Strada, the only woman in history to ever race the Giro d'Italia. Our guest, Ilona Comps, has honored her with a photo novel rebuilt from the damp news clippings of her forgotten triumph. Later, we'll hear from another author and journalist, April Streeter, to tell us some of those same, to tell us about some of those same women who brightened their heyday in, but like many women in history, have been largely forgotten, at least until now. First, Alon is going to bring us some of the latest headlines for this week, February 6th, 2018. Alon?
Yes, thank you. The first two are reported by the always informative bikeportland.org. A new 23-mile trail, a former logging road between Scappoose and Vernonia, received a $150,000 matching grant from the Oregon Parks and Recreation Department. The project will memorize bicycle advocate Wayne Nalon, who loved this trail. Another local story, after hundreds of comments, competing online petitions, and a rowdy meeting, the city of Portland changed its initial Lincoln-Harrison Neighborhood Greenway Enhancement Project. Several automobile drivers complained that the improved bike access will make their lives harder, but the Bureau of Transportation argued that if we don't shift to more cycling, Portland will need 23 Powell Boulevards crisscrossing every neighborhood in the city to handle traffic by 2025. They also stated, Portland has decided it would be better to design for and encourage more walking, biking, and transit use than to build enough roadway capacity to ease increased driving. Climate change, congestion, individual health, community health, and environmental health are a few of these reasons. The Bureau is also planning more speed bumps and safer crossings across the city. An article in PeopleForBikes.org reports an encouraging rise in bicycle use in Puerto Rico after the recent hurricane that left hundreds dead. Jorge Flores de Jesus, a young lawyer, founded an organization lobbying for increased investment in cycling. Before the disaster, only 2% of workers commuted by mass transit and only 0.3% by bike. Crisis generates opportunities, said the young activist. His work with issues of public debt convinced him of the need for improved and accessible infrastructure and less dependence on fossil fuels. Since the September 20th hurricane, with so many roads damaged, more Puerto Ricans have been hopping on bicycles. Losing a beloved bicycle is never easy. Cycling Weekly reports that the day before Christmas, 88-year-old Nottingham, England cyclist Alan Lovett had his bike, the one he has ridden over 300,000 miles since 1949, stolen from a garden shed. He has described the bike as a faithful friend. So if by chance you have seen a brown bronze touring bike with a distinctive Rotrax frame made in 1949 and with a black leather Brooks saddle, please return it to its friend. And finally, in a story related to today's show's theme, WeLoveCycling.com reports that South Australian government officials have announced that the riders in the women's Tour Down Under will receive the same pay as male riders. The prize pool for women will increase by $90,000 from the current $15,000. As the South Australian Sports Minister, Leon Bignell, said, "These athletes are at the top of their game, displaying professionalism, determination, and skill during every stage of the hard-fought race. It's only fair that the prize money they will receive is on par with their male counterparts." Well said, and may this parity expand to all races and other areas of life.
Thank you so much, Alan, for that update. Ilona Kamp is a Dutch photographer who focuses mainly on reportage and portraits. A cyclist herself, Ilona Kamp has ridden many of the great cyclosportifs to test herself alongside the men. She joins us today from Kamperland, Netherlands, to talk about her photo novel, Alfonsina, which is a tribute to the great and mostly unknown Italian cyclist, Alfonsina Strada.
We're here talking with Ilona Kamp, a Dutch photographer and cyclist who produced a wonderful book about an amazing cyclist of 100 years ago, Alfonsina Strada, an Italian cyclist. We're glad to have you on our show. Good day to you.
Hello. all from the Netherlands.
Yeah, all the way from the Netherlands. You're our first guest from the Netherlands. Tell us a little bit about Alfonsina Strada. How did you hear about this cyclist? How was the project born?
And can you also, yes, can we also add to that, who was she?
Yes, I will tell. I will tell both. But in 2011, I visited Maradona di Ghisallo, and there's a little chapel. And in this chapel is a pilgrimage for racing cyclists. And there are all bicycles of famous riders in the church. And besides the bicycle from Dino Bartali, I spotted Alfonsina's bicycle. And there was also a notice on her bicycle. And on this notice states, it is in Italian, "Bicicletta di Alfonsina, prima donna al Giro d'Italia anno 1924. Now, that reference, and that she could ride the Giro in at that time, that touched me, and I was ashamed I didn't know it. Later I found out more information and discovered a small book that's written about her. I read a book. It's from a sport journalist, Paolo Facchinetti. It was translated from Italian to Dutch, so I can understand it well, and it gives me a good overview how I have to see the story of Alfonsina in that time. And also Facchinetti say in his book that the history was narrated with personal meanings and seen with a prevailing morality. So I was thinking, okay, what do I have to do with my tribute to Alfonsina? And I started to collect all the proven facts I found in a book and also in on the internet, and make a route from all places where she had been and where she was in her life. And so the project was born, and then I started to travel.
So you essentially made a map of all the places that she had been and started following your own map.
Yeah, it was not a map, it was a list.
And did it go, that list, through her entire life, or was it just her cycling career?
No, her whole life, where she was born, and I haven't been everywhere, but I don't went to the whole Giro, but I want to go. I want to go. Where is she born? Where does she come from? Where did she live? What is there now on that in that place? Because I need to make the connection with the present. The history has the connection, have the connection for me with the present.
And what is her background? What can you tell us about her family and her early life?
Yeah, she was born in the north part of Italy, in Castelfranco Emilia, and she was the second child of in the family and of 10 children, and her parents were day laborers, and it was hard. It was almost impossible to earn the basic needs for living in that time.
And how did she start cycling? In one place I read that her father sold a pig to get her a bicycle. Is that another one of the myths that grew about her?
Yeah, one day he came home with the old bicycle from the doctor. He exchanged it for some chickens and a couple of odd jobs. But it was not often seen as bike, it was his bike. But at one day, when the bike was there and the father was not there, Alfonsina took the bike, and she tried to get up. She was quite little, but when she managed a fantastic machine, once a bicycle was in those days a machine, and this gave her the speed of the sense of speed and freedom, and she raced around in the village and along the roads, and I think it's my thought she felt the freedom and a way to escape of the miserable conditions of poverty where she lives in.
And how old was she about at this point when she first started riding?
Around 10.
Wow. That bike had to be far too big for her.
And did she start competing fairly early against boys also? How did she do when she was competing against boys?
Yeah, in the beginning she was just racing in the village with all the other kids, also with boys, and she was the fastest. And in the village they give her the nickname the devil in a dress. So it was not normal a girl once to ride a bike, and she was just riding it so fast that they call her sometimes the lunatic.
What? Yeah, I'm sure those bikes were not as stable as the ones that we ride now, and the roads were not nearly as nice as the ones that we have today.
No, I'm for sure they were not paved.
So they
were gravel roads.
So how did she make it to the Giro, which for our listeners who, it's the Italian version or similar to the Tour de France and has been around also for 100 years or so?
Yeah, more than 100 years. It was it's number 101 mm-hmm. this year.
Mm-hmm.
And now, she left home when she was 16, I think. And she went to Torino, and there was a more modern influence. And there were more cycling races, also other women who are cycling. And so there she started competing and be a better racer. But soon, 1 or 2 years later, she was the best race, woman racer of Italy. And she set a world record. It was not an official record, because for women there were no records.
Right. Why would we keep track of women?
And they had a world record on the 500 meters. And so she was very talented. And that brings her in a demonstration team. And she was invited to race in the court of the Tsar Nicholas in St. Petersburg. And so she get more, they give her more serious attention, because she gets there and no one of her village came ever there. And so it's, she get more chances. And in 1911, she wrote was our record, and it was 37K, 192 meters.
Wow.
So this record was, I think, in the 30s of the 40s was is broken, but it's still for a long time this record.
You are listening to the KBO Bike Show. In the studio are Tori Bortman and Alon Robb, and we're happy to have as our guest Ilona Kamps, a Dutch cyclist and journalist, photographer, who's talking about her beautiful book about an amazing Italian racer, Alfonsina Strada, who in 1924 rode in the Giro d'Italia, the only woman who did it till today, I believe.
Yes.
Ilona, so the race itself, the Giro, which is, it's at different times, it's different distances, but usually it's about 3,000 kilometers or?
3,600, I think.
Okay. So how did it work for her? How was she able to disguise her identity as a woman?
There was a twist between the organization of the Giro and the teams of the champions. The teams want to have an extra fee for the champions, and the organization don't want to pay it. And at that moment, the organization makes a decision to ask all cyclists with a valid competent license. They were able to ride the Giro, and that gave Alfonsina the chance to register her for this Giro. And in the first time, they were in doubt on, will we have this woman in our Giro? But they were also afraid to have no attention, because there were no big names. So
she was essentially a publicity stunt, kind of, to help
promote
the Giro.
Yeah, but they thought, after 2 stages, she get off, and then we just have the normal Giro, and we have the attention, so it becomes okay. But for Alfonsina, there was a dream come true. So She made this Giro until the end. She had a lot of problems, and she didn't. I think the stage 9, she crossed the finish line too late. But in the day before, there were two men. They were also too late, and they were allowed to ride the Giro, but not in competition. So that was the same for Alfonsina. So she is not enlisted, but there are three names under the 30 who are finished in the list. And after, see, there is often seen.
And how did the other racers, the men, and also the crowds react to her?
In the beginning, they were very surprised because the story is telling they don't know, but I can imagine because she was quite known as a racer. So when she was there, and it was most Italian men, they know her, but the most don't like she was there.
Yeah. And, I would imagine that in some of the, you know, Italy's so many small villages together, that a lot of people weren't expecting to see her because maybe they hadn't heard of her or known that she was allowed in. So I bet there was some surprise out there.
Yeah, yes, and the journalists were making a kind of character from her, and the people are shouting and yelling to her that she has to go home and take care of her husband and not riding a bike.
So in other words, not much has changed between then and today.
I think that they changed a little bit, but no, there isn't any woman riding a grand tour at the moment.
So
I think that has to be changed. That must be changed.
So she raced, and then what happened after the race? And I'm also interested in the period because, you know, the fascists were coming to power around that time, and very masculine, macho culture, of course. What happens to her?
Yes, she was those years. It was. In a stage, and after the stage there was a rest day, and the next stage, because the stages were very long. When Alfonsina was finishing, she had to wait to get a hotel and a room, but later she had to wait when all the riders were has a massage or she something like this, then she can have it. So she was always the last who was going to sleep, and she had the worst position at that moment, I think.
I'd love to ask you a little bit about your beautiful book. Because the photographs are just stunning. So those are not photographs of Alfonsina, but of models kind of recreating some of what she did. Is that correct?
Yeah, they are all new pictures. There are not much pictures left because the scrapbooks of Alfonsina were lost in the cellar of her brother. It flew, and so it was destroyed. So there are some pictures in the archives, but there are not much. And everything was telling about her. It's in the earlier years, it is colored. So I just think I have to make my own story to see it, how it could be. So that, and I just want to give a kind of atmosphere.
Yes.
With my pictures.
Yes,
and there
a...
you have to find your story of Alfonsina, because I think everybody has his own look through the pictures.
Yes, and I think,
and find his own story.
I think what amazes me is not only that you were so accurately able to recreate through costumes and things that the look of that period in time, but also that part of the reason we love watching the Giro today is you kind of get a sense of, just because of the regions that they're in and the way the roads are, when you're watching it on TV today, you get this sense of history. And in these photos, you really bring that history to life.
Oh, thank you.
And who were the models? How did you find them? And
Sometimes they are just in my picture. When I was somewhere, there is someone who crossed my image, mm-hmm. and sometimes it was someone who looks, mostly it was someone who looks like Alfonsina. So it was also sometimes I think she feels so close by that she was a kind of directing all this for her new photo book.
Well, you are listening to the KBO Bike Show in the studio of Tori Bortman and Alon Raab. And we're honored to have as our guest Ilona Kamps, who is talking to us from the Netherlands about her wonderful book about Alfonsina Strada, a early woman cyclist in Italy who is still the first and only woman who rode the entire Giro d'Italia. Ilona, you've also done other projects about cycling and cyclists. Can you tell us a little bit about those?
Yes. I'm not a sport photographer. I'm more interested in stories of cycling, and not only the top cyclists. So I went in 2012, there I went to Uganda in Africa. And there I also stayed 2 weeks with a cycling club and to see how they are doing the training and how I do their matches the most things I saw, the when you look at it you think everything is different, but I also see a lot of things we have in common, so like the pleasure of being good in riding a bike and have fun with this sport, and that is why I make a report for about.
And are you working on any project now? Or?
Yes, I do the long-term project with the public and the spectators of watching cycling in Belgium and France and also Italy, and that project I work on since 2008. And I think I will work there the next 5 years, so it will become a large project. And I work at the second part of Alfonsina. Mm-hmm. I'm making a traveling exposition unit to bring her story everywhere where it could be.
And if somebody wants to find your book, how would they be able to order it, or is it going to be published in the U.S.?
I published it myself, so I have also to sell it, and you can sell it at the website. It's alfonsinastrada.com.
Okay, and we'll
and
add it to our website also.
Yes, and on our Facebook page.
And there you can find the way you can order the book and pay the book, and then I will send it over the ocean.
Okay, and our time is almost up. It's gone by like one of Alfonsina's races, very fast. But Tori, perhaps the last question from you.
I was going to ask about the project that you had just been mentioning about kind of almost the lifestyle, and it seems you've done an amazing job documenting the feel of the crowd and the interactions with the cyclists, both the cyclists' pain, because so many of us can't or aren't those kind of riders or athletes, but so many more of us are able to be spectators and participate in that way. What inspired you to document that?
I don't understand the whole question, sorry.
Oh, what inspired you to document not just the racers, but the you do such a beautiful job of telling the story of the race from the perspective of not just the racers, but also the spectators who are watching.
Yeah, it's just because I'm also a spectator, so we are spectators and we are waiting, and the waiting is a part of the exciting to stay there and wait for the peloton, and I just took the peloton, but they are mostly are of in emotion, or they are on sharp, and then the spectators, they have the faces and the you can see what they like about it, what they are passionated, and that's what I like to see, and also the sport is so close in the public space, so it's just kept in through every street or through every city, and that's what I think to find very special about cycling.
Yeah, that's beautiful, and I think you do a very good job of bringing that part of racing to life. So thank you for your work and your artistry.
Oh, thank you.
We have been talking with Ilona Kamps, who kindly agreed to be interviewed all the way from the Netherlands, from Zeeland, an island in southwest Netherlands. She's been talking about her new book about Alfonsina Strada, an Italian racer of 100 years ago. Thank you so much, Ilona, for being on our show, and all the best to you.
Yeah, thank you, too.
If you'd like to know more about Ilona Kamps or her work, Alfonsina, we will have the link up to her website after the show on our Facebook page. You are listening to the KBOO Bike Show on KBOO.FM and 90.7 FM. Stay with us for the second half of our show when we continue our look at early women in the sport of cycling that paved the way for our sport and our nation.
Something doesn't change.
Welcome back to the KBOO Bike Show on 90.7 FM. Today we're digging into early women in the sport of cycling that paved the way for our sport and our nation. Our next guest, April Streeter, is an author and journalist, blogger at Treehugger, and historian of women on bicycles. She joins us today to talk about her latest projects and to enlighten us about overlooked women in the history of cycling. Welcome to the show, April Streeter.
Thanks, Tori. Thanks for having me.
So, first, for our listeners who may not be as well educated about the history of the bicycle, can you give us a quick overview of how the evolution of the bicycle and the history of women's rights kind of overlapped? Because they're pretty intertwined.
Okay. Well, women were biking right from the start of biking. And that's something that I think a lot of us don't really know or realize. So if you look back to the 1870s or even the 1860s, you found that women were biking during that time period. It's just that they weren't advertised, really, in the same way that men who were biking were.
What were they biking for?
Well,
exercise, pleasure, or to get around?
I think in the early women, they were actually biking for all those things, but they were racing. They were interested in racing.
So it was for sport.
Yeah. If you look at the 1860s, and this is in Paris, you see that women from took up right from the start on the velocipedes. And velocipedes were incredibly heavy and hard to ride cycles. But women did it, and they were in those early races, and they were having even their own races. So I would say that they did it for the freedom, first of all, and second of all, for the pleasure. And then lastly, to, I guess, their idea of equality or being able to race just like the guys did.
Well, I'm surprised that they, quote unquote, were allowed to.
Yeah, the restrictions would come a little bit later. So if we're talking about the 1860s, yes, they were allowed to, but I think it's because racing wasn't organized at that time, and the men's biking groups that would form later in the U.S. weren't organized at that time, so it was a little bit of free-for-all.
Yeah. Okay.
And there are some wonderful illustrations from French magazines and British papers of women riding during those races and looking pretty wild.
Yes.
And having men and women look surprised to see them. What were some of the obstacles that these racers faced, or was it pretty accepted?
Well, I think if you talk about the 1860s, the obstacles were more or less not set up yet. So it might have been an obstacle of clothing. And I think it's interesting that the illustrations that you're talking about, when they were translated for the American market, they were made a little bit more demure. So, for example, that famous one on the of racing in France, the women were shown with their skirts shorter, and then when they brought that illustration over for Harper's Magazine, they actually added petticoats, which would have been impossible to have those flapping petticoats if you were riding a bicycle. But they put
Without the petticoats.
Exactly. So at the beginning, there weren't as many obstacles. Then when you move into the 1870s, and then we get into the high wheel era. So those bikes had these huge front wheels, they were direct drive still, and tiny back wheels. Now that was a bit more of an obstacle clothing-wise for women who were wearing many pounds of petticoats and undergarments.
And for those of you who might also know that as a penny farthing.
Exactly.
Yeah.
They were called ordinaries by the people of that era, but we've a little later put the name on there of penny farthing. So those bikes were difficult to ride, not only because of women's constricting clothing, but also because they were difficult to mount. I mean, they were very high, you know, 5 feet high.
They put our tall bikes now to shame.
Exactly.
A little bit. Yeah.
Yeah, because you had just a little peg on the back of the frame. You had to get a little speed going up to clamber on, and those were all things that were harder for a woman to do when she couldn't wear pants.
Yeah.
So
getting, it's hard enough for me wearing pants some days to get my leg over the saddle, but I can't.
So as the women's movement, developed, increased in number and effect, what happened as far as cyclists?
Well, okay, I have to step back here for a second, because when we look at women's rights or the 19th Amendment. So it was prior to the beginning of bicycling that women like Elizabeth Cady Stanton were organizing and trying to get this suffrage movement going. And that was already 1848 when the Seneca Falls Convention happened. And so that organizational start was before the first era of biking as we know it, or biking in general.
Well, it was almost a whole generation.
It was
then.
A generation before. So unfortunately, women like Susan B. Anthony didn't live long enough to see the 19th Amendment come into ratification in 1920. So that's a huge period of time, 1848 to 1920.
Well, what I find fascinating about that, though, is I'm assuming that the women who were racing were young because
yes.
they hadn't been married or pregnant
right.
yet. And they might have been the daughters of those people that had
exactly.
fought for those and started the movement.
Yeah, exactly. In the same way that Amelia Bloomer, she was kind of part of that same group, Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Susan B. Anthony. And she designed this outfit that would be easier to wear. It didn't have as many petticoats. It had those Bloomer-like pants. But she never really wore it that much. She kind of got laughed out of places where she tried to wear it. But then later on, you know, decades later, that Bloomer outfit really helped later women who mm-hmm. wanted to cycle. To a certain degree. So going back to, so I think they ran concurrently, if you think about the suffrage movement and then the emancipation that the bicycle allowed, they were parallel, but they didn't really completely overlap. That's my perspective.
And there's a famous statement by Susan B. Anthony, the bicycle has done more to emancipate women than any one thing in the world. I rejoice every time I see a woman on a bike. It gives her a feeling of self-reliance and independence, the moment she takes her seat, and away she goes, the picture of untrammeled womanhood. What do you think she meant exactly by that? Was she exaggerating with the statement?
Well, the first thing is that I think it's interesting that she was able to make that statement, which is full of feeling, when she herself, as far as anyone knows, was not a cyclist. So she never biked. But I guess she could see already that the bike had such a capacity for freedom for women.
Well, and if she was seeing it in the next generation.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. So she didn't bike, but I think she could see that the possibilities were there, inherent in the bicycle. So,
You know so much about this period.
I know.
How did you start wanting to read? What about this hooked you in?
Well, in 2010, I moved to Portland from Sweden, and I had been living in Gothenburg, and bicycling was so much a part of the infrastructure, and it was just normal. And then I came back here. It was away for 5 years. And when I was bicycling, I had this sensation that there was still so much competition in the bike lanes, and it still felt so much more stressful than it had in Sweden. And so I started looking into why that was, and I got involved in the different things about women and biking and the fact that women weren't biking as much as men. And so I decided, as an author, I'll write a book. And so I went back through the history of biking just to write a short synopsis of the history of the bicycle. And it seemed to me men did it all. They invented all the technology of the bicycle. They were the ones riding. Women supposedly weren't riding, especially in that 1870, 1880 period. And that just seemed like that can't be true. There's a hidden history of women here that I want to find. And so that's how I got fascinated, was that hidden history that really hadn't come out yet. And it made it seem as if it was all mostly white guys and middle-class white guys in that beginning period. And I knew that couldn't be true. So that's what drove me on and kind of pushed me forward to see what else was there under the surface.
There is a blind spot when it comes to a lot of the history, the history books about bicycles, like David Hurley's Yale University Press book, Bicycle, The History.
Yeah.
Out of 400 pages, it has quite a lot about women.
It does.
Out of 400 pages, it only has one page about China and India, which luckily now there are a few new histories, and there are a new generation of cyclists and historians, men and women, who are paying attention. Who are some of these women you discovered? Any women our audience should know about?
So there were quite a few. And if we start out thinking about the 1860s and then the 1870s, I'd say that my specialty period is the 1880s. And I discovered that women were actually racing the high wheel bike, the penny farthing or the ordinary. And that was fascinating to me. And so I discovered that there was first a small group. And of that group, two who stood out to me were one woman named Elsa von Blumen.
She was from the East Coast. Which is a great name.
Yeah. It was a made-up name. It wasn't her real name.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, it was a made-up name. And Louise Armando. And these two women had learned to cycle in the early 1880s, and their background was that they were pedestrians, which means they were race walkers. So they did these spectacles at early tracks, where they would walk for sometimes days on end, and it was a sort of endurance test. And when that sport or spectacle had a little bit of a dip, they transferred their skills, their endurance skills, to the bicycle, and they learned how to ride the high wheel. And so the types of races that they were doing in this early period, which was before the League of American Wheelmen had really kind of codified the rules around racing, these women would go to newspapers and create a challenge. So they would just put a challenge into the newspaper and say, I challenge a racer for $500 for a 50-mile race or something like that. And they'd do that challenge, and then people would come and they'd do these races. So they were somewhat casual affairs.
It's completely DIY.
Yeah.
It's completely like throwing out the gauntlet, putting a flyer up and saying, come all to this alley cat.
Yeah, exactly.
Almost. That's amazing.
It is. And at the same time, there was more of a racing sort of rule book style racing that was kind of coming into being. And it was basically, I think that the Brits had figured it out a little better. And so as the League of American Wheelmen, which was established in 1880, got up and going, they started making the rules by which racing could happen. And they made a distinction between amateurs and professionals. And that was a big distinction, because once you were a professional, which meant you wanted to race for money, you could no longer ever be an amateur. So there's a lot of controversy around that. But that, in some ways, pushed these women, these fledgling racers, out of it as well. So Louise Armando and Elsa von Blumen were the two women that I really became fascinated with, because nobody knew. Nobody knew that these women were racing these high-wheel bikes. In fact, most histories will say that women didn't even ride them, ride these bikes.
Because they were too
hard
to ride and
dangerous.
Well, and also just uncomely, you know,
not exactly
something a woman would want to be seen on.
Exactly.
And I'm assuming if there were purses, meaning payments, money, that there were spectators.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
It's crazy that it could be so
hidden
or erased kind of from history.
Yeah, but it's all there. And by 1889, so if you look at my two racers, early 1880s. By 1889, there was a complete influx of even younger women who were athletes, who were riding the high-wheel bike and racing. And so that, the entire idea was just so novel and interesting to me that that's how I became completely obsessed, which is what you need to do if you're going to write a novel about a time period like that. You need that obsession.
Which is your
factor.
Current project.
That's my current project.
And these women were of all backgrounds, races?
Well, that's interesting to think about in itself. If you look at Louise Armando, she's the main character in my story. She was from a more working class background. And then Elsa was from a more, let's say, middle class background. And most of the men who were riding were from a middle class background. So, because you had to be at least in a working class where you could afford to buy a bicycle for $100, which would take you quite a while. Mm. Or you were middle class and you were part of these clubs and you had the money and the wherewithal to buy a bicycle and have the leisure time to ride it. So, yeah.
Or you had to borrow one, win enough races, and then get your own.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, because the whole idea of sponsorship and bike companies, you know, wanting you to ride their bicycles hadn't yet quite come into play in the 1880s. It was just starting. So
one rider I always found fascinating is Kitty Knox, who was completely an original. Can you tell us about her?
I can tell you a little bit about Kitty. There are people who have done more research on what she did, but basically she became a member of the League of American Wheelmen before there was this huge controversy about race and membership. And so before that time period, she became a card-carrying member. And she went to a convention in Asbury Park, New Jersey, and she had on a beautiful bloomer outfit that she had made herself that she had already previously won a prize for. And so I think she assumed that they would let her into this convention. And I think they were confused about what they should do, because that was the time period that it was starting, this idea of that we don't want to have the African-American membership allowed through the league. And it was similar today, that there was, you know, a whole range of ideas and notions about it, and not necessarily a majority of people that didn't want African-American or black people to be in the league, but there was also this faction that was fighting hard to keep them out. So Kitty went to this convention.
Well, and I think just to break in really faster, there's a little piece of history there that people don't realize, that race actually wasn't, it was more mixed.
It was.
At that point, especially on the East Coast.
Yes.
That racism as we know it today actually wasn't as pronounced in some ways, or it was a different...
Well, it wasn't as pronounced, but it was true that there was some, perhaps, self-segregation. I think that the cycling clubs that were black or African-American, those were black African-American. And then I think the white guys' clubs were still pretty hard to breach.
Yeah.
But you're right.
But I mean, in culture in general,
there was more
mixing of people. And,
definitely.
And not as much judgment in some ways, considering there was still slavery going on in the South.
I think so.
In the North, it was a little bit different.
Yeah.
So she went
to the convention, and she had her really cute bloomer cycling outfit, and she showed her card, and the guy at the desk did not want to let her in. And so that caused a huge controversy of people both for and against her being there. But she's just a historic figure that we should remember as somebody who had the gumption to go to the convention riding her bike, riding her outfit, and show up and say, okay, I have just as much right as you other cyclists to be here.
You're listening to the KBO Bike Show. We're here with author and journalist April Streeter as she continues our conversation about overlooked female heroes of cycling. You mentioned a novel in progress. Can you share a few pages
and I have a couple,
set it up?
I have a couple pages that I hope give a good overview of what it was like to race in that time period. And so I'll go ahead and read those.
Yeah.
Madison Square Garden. Despite the stormy weather, there was a large crowd of spectators this evening. Leakage from the roof made a wet and dangerous track. A number of professional people and prominent citizens were present. The fastest 25 miles were covered by Armando in 100 minutes. Syracuse Standard, February 17, 1889. The girls, they were sometimes referred to as bicycling women, though never female athletes, bunched together at the starting line, each balancing her bicycle at her side by the handlebars. Their viewing point from the wooden track floor made Madison Square Garden hover above, a dark hulk of a building, badly lit in yellowy glow from gas chandeliers, smelling of sweat, ancient plaster, and old-growth mildew. The brightest image in the entire giant square at 12th and Madison was a dozen white tents, the girls' resting tents, set in two neat lines in the track's inner oval. And of course, the bright girls themselves. Close up, their costumes were excessive, a little gaudy. There was chunky Lottie Stanley in crimson plush jacket and oversized gilt buttons, Elsa von Blumen with her plumed hat and silver sack with gold spangles, and Louise Armando, who always aimed to outdo, in baby blue jacket, cerulean tights, a royal blue sash, and a scarlet cap. Spread out at the start line as they were, from the spectator seats, the 11 girl riders were a string of semi-precious stones on a crooked necklace. If they looked ahead of them, the girls noticed the shiny patches, indicating wetness on the wooden track, but the racers had no power to do anything about those slick puddles. Clutching the handlebars of their high-wheeled bikes, they could only wait for the band to begin to pump passion into the crowd, which currently milled and chattered and placed bets and smoked. On the final leg of the final evening of this six-day race, Louise was already bilious. She stared fixedly at the red, white, and blue bunting decorations dotting the high walls of the garden and focused on trying to count the folds on each fan, trying to calm the sloshy queasiness in her stomach, stanch the sensation that she must relieve her bladder and bowels yet again. Two girls down the row, Elsa held herself statue still, with only her colorless cheeks as indication of her possible internal state. In contrast, the race leader, Lottie, nearest to the inside curve of the track, radiated confidence. She let her trainer keep her bike held up while she spent long moments arranging a tribute garland of carnations around her neck. The band striking up, horns sounding, strings screeching, brought all 11 girls to attention, and by the time the music reached crescendo, the girls were hoisted, each to her bike saddle. Now the crowd played its part, milling just a bit more before settling into positions of expectation. In the cheap section, scores of students sporting blue and white Columbia University scarves had no seats. Closer to the action, the men who could afford a seat and the hundreds of ladies afforded one sank into them. It was 7:58 p.m. 4 hours of intense track circling lay ahead.
4 hours.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
Yeah. They would do 6 day races. So they would race 6 days in succession for a number of hours each day.
You did a wonderful job of carrying us to that period and place.
Oh,
I wanted
good.
To know what's happening here. What will happen with this race? So the characters are obviously based on real
yes.
individuals. So what can you give us a little teaser, maybe an overview of where you're going with this novel and
okay.
what it's about?
Well, this section that I read to you was actually from the climax of the book. And so I follow the fortunes of Louise Armando and Elsa von Blumen as they try and basically make a living from this type of racing. And then what happens to them over time as they race each other and they race men and sometimes win and sometimes lose. But then they come to this time period in 1889 when this influx of really awesome female athletes comes into the game, and at the same time, the League of American Wheelmen is trying to squelch bicycle racing for women. And they did so by blacklisting any of the tracks that would try and hold the races. So if you were a promoter and you tried to have a race for women and you set up an event because you knew, you know, these costumes and slightly gaudy things that people would wear would bring in both the men and the women, and then you'd set this all up, and then your track would be blacklisted by the LAW. So that was pretty effective way to squelch.
It's 100%. It worked like a charm.
Yeah, it did work like
a charm. Well, it's just so interesting, too, as it reflects to how our modern-day sport is no longer the League of American Bicyclists who tell us what's going on, but the UCI, which I'm trying to remember what UCI stands for. It's French, but it's basically the governing body of cycling.
Yeah.
The fact that at the beginning of the hour, Alan had made an announcement of there being actual parity in payout, and the difference in parity and payout in 2018 was that the women were making, the highest payout was $15,000 total for all the women's prizes, and is now going up to $90,000. So it's that moment that the League of American Bicyclists said and pushed the women out. We're just getting over that moment.
Yes,
over 100 years later.
Well, that's the thing when you ask the question about the way that the women's movement and bicycling kind of moved in tandem and stuff. I don't think that the women who are at the Seneca Falls Convention could have ever anticipated that it would take so long to get the 19th Amendment passed. And it's the same thing with women's cycling. I don't think any of us could ever anticipated, or those women who raced in 1889, that it would be, many, many decades until they could get equal pay.
Yeah, it's startling and insane, and I'm glad that it's changing.
Yes, exactly.
And it's really heartening to know that there was a time that women got paid and could be professional cyclists.
Exactly.
And live and eat, because the women who are professional cyclists right now have to have another job.
Exactly.
Or someone fully supporting them, as in a partner, husband, or someone in their family.
Exactly.
So, it's amazing.
Our time is almost up. It went by as fast as some of these women racers you described. Tori, maybe a last question.
Where can we find more about your work and the work that you've already published? Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, the first book that I did, Women on Wheels, that had some of these case studies, and that has at least 10 case studies of women that I found through the ages, all the way up through World War II, who were cyclists or did something to advance cycling. And I'm working on another edition of that one, so we'll have at least twice as many case studies, and that will be out, I hope, in 2019, but it might be pushed a little further because I haven't quite finished the text yet. And other than that, at seriouspress.com, you can get the first edition of Women on Wheels.
And where is that? Can you spell that for our listeners?
A Serious Press, so A Serious Press, all one, all together, .com.
Excellent. And our listeners, if you're out there and interested, you can find that on our Facebook page, The KBOO Bike Show on Facebook. Thank you so much, April Streeter, for joining us today. It was really lovely having you. And I do want to make a short announcement that April will be joining us as our new co-host. She'll be joining the KBOO Bike Show team coming up soon, so you won't just get to appreciate her wisdom here as a guest, but also as a co-host. You've been listening to the KBOO Bike Show, broadcast from Portland, Oregon, on the first Wednesday of every month. We'll have links to all our guests' websites on our Facebook page. That's Facebook, the KBOO Bike Show. Podcasts are on iTunes, and all past episodes are generously archived at thebikeshow.portlandtransport.com. The Bike Show is produced by myself, Alon Robb, and Terry Campbell. We'd like to thank our in-studio engineer, Tammy, without whom we'd be fumbling through the airwaves, our web host, Chris Smith, and today's guests, as well as our editor, Josh Hetrick. If you have comments, questions, or show ideas, The Bike Show would love to hear from you. You can contact us on Facebook at our Twitter handle, @KBOOBikeShow, or email us through the KBOO website. We'll be back next month with more news and views from the bike world. Until then, make it a great day and keep riding your bike.
thinking of a girl I met, a phone call that I haven't made yet. All the things I've done this week, and all the things I should have done instead. I sweep the pavements and the parks, I hope that I get home before it's dark. And my mama tells me I should stop, go and get a real job, that can be the way that I roll. And everybody's growing up, having kids and paying rent, they're all getting caught on their own. I'm gonna ride my bike until I get home. I'm gonna ride my bike until I get home. I'm gonna ride my bike until I get home. I'm gonna ride my bike until I get home. I can't understand it, but I can't.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. The Engineering Committee will meet on the first Wednesday at 7 p.m.
Help us help you keep Portland weird. Join Contessa de la Luna of the World Famous Confessional for the 6th annual Contessa de la Luna Valentine's Spectacular and Fashion Show. We're giving away a $100 cash prize plus live performances by Contessa de la Luna. Get your weird on and bring a date. Advance tickets available at Brown Paper Tickets. All proceeds benefit your community radio station, KBOO. That's Thursday, February 15th, 7 to 9:45 p.m. Feel the love of your other Contessa de la Lunatics. Contessa de la Luna's Valentine's Spectacular, Thursday, February 15th at the Clinton Street Theater, 7 p.m.